Almost. Before we get into the words today, I do want to give an update. As John was doing these prayer requests, the youth got to go visit Louise and her husband in the home that they're at on Christmas Eve, and we sang some Christmas carols, and that woman is a firecracker. So we go into this room where, you know, there's people who are really active and people who are very inactive in their response to you. And, you know, Lincoln's running around in his little Santa suit. Like Joe was with us, my mom was with us, and it was really cool. We kind of gathered a group of people together, and I can show you pictures later if you guys want. But then, you know, there's maybe 8 or so people in there. We're singing Christmas carols with them. And then Louise is like, let's go sing to people in their rooms. So Louise, like, is, you know, she's got her cane and she's like walking around and, like, you know, we're singing in all these different rooms and stuff like that. She's a light in that place. Like, and it's super cool to see. Lincoln was trying to steal balloons from old people, and that was a whole nother. We got a long way to go with that kid, so I almost want to put it as a prayer request, but anyway. But yeah, so just want to give you a little update on Louise since I saw her about a week ago. So she's doing really well. Let's pray again. Because I gotta settle. I'll tell you a little bit about kind of the 24 hours leading up to here. Father, I thank you for today. I thank you for your word and how it centers us. I thank you for providing for us amongst chaos, Lord. And Father, I pray that you will be with us today as we study your word. Lord, please guide me in teaching and preaching, Lord, and guide us in our hearts towards a humble reception of your word today, Lord. Father, we thank you and we praise you. It's in your name we pray. Amen. So the time leading up to this was interesting. It was I didn't get to confirm with John that I could preach today until like Wednesday night at like 8 p.m. because Brian was working. And then we had like broom ball on Friday night. No one died, which is good. Maybe a little bit of pride for some people who were playing goalie, but you know, whatever. But we had broom ball with the youth, and that was super good. And then yesterday I wake up, you know, I'm doing my normal routine. I go and I play podcasts and stuff while I'm getting ready in the morning. And I go and put my phone on the little thing, and it falls down and completely breaks. Like, you guys have seen shattered screens before? Well, so like the way phones work is there's like a screen and then like an LCD behind it that's actually what you see and respond to. That's broken too. So it wasn't even just like the shattered glass, but it was also the LCD. So it's like completely rendered useless. And I was like, man, today is going to be like one of those days. And I had to spend like an hour and a half on the phone with phone insurance. And thankfully, that's going to be replaced and, you know, all that good stuff early this week. But so like that's the start of it. And then like, all right, cool. Finishing up stuff for today. And then Samantha starts, I'm not feeling good at all. You know, like right after I get off the phone, I'm like, man, okay. Is it morning sickness? Like, you know, what's going on? Well, I guess this would be afternoon sickness. You know, what's going on? And meanwhile, while we're trying to figure that out, Lincoln figured out that he can jump off the couch. He's 16 months old, for anyone who hasn't met him yet. So, like, it's this weird juxtaposition. My wife's like, ugh, and my kid's like, cowabunga, dude. Like, I'm jumping off of the couch onto his new giant stuffed animal dinosaur, which we got for him. Needless to say, it's been crazy. I was up late with Samantha last night. Brian's like, I'm hugging a toilet, you know. everyone's out of town, but God is good, and He's brought us here to this moment. And I hope that today, in spite of my normal Sunday routine, which is get up at a certain time, review my notes, go to breakfast with Samantha, talk about what I'm going to speak about, review my notes again, right? Like, just kind of have it all fresh up here. Guess what I haven't done yet? Any of that. So, but let's get into Matthew 18. And as you turn there, I want to remind you something. I want to remind you of the greater overall application of what Jesus Christ is doing in the book of Matthew. And I want to remind you that, John has titled this, and I think he's titled it really well, is that this is all about the upside-down kingdom. Jesus came, there's expectations about who he was, who he is, and he flipped them all on his head. Right? People were like, you're going to come as a ruling king. We see that like later on where, when he comes in on donkeys and they're basically waving their versions of American flags with the palm fronds, and they're coming in and you're king, and yet a king comes and dies on a cross. And if you remember a couple weeks ago, we looked at like what are kings doing going out and like humbly serving people, right? That's not kingly if from a worldly perspective, right? He flips all of our ideas of what it means to be us on its head. And I think that that's really an important context as we dive into this word, because as we examine the text and as we look at it, both take that as a personal challenge and a general challenge of what do I think I know, and how can I be humbled before God to what he wants me to know here? If you remember the context of this, what John preached on last week, and he said it repeatedly throughout Matthew, is that like we must be humble as followers of Christ. Like, I don't know how many times I came across that as I was just reading over the passages and reading various commentaries and various things coming up to this point. It was like, man, if we're not humble coming before God, then we've missed the mark already. So today we'll be in Matthew 18, 7 through 14. And I don't want to re-preach on it, but we are going to read 1 through 6 as well, because I think it contextualizes our text today really well. So we're going to start in Matthew 18, 1. And at that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly, I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be greater for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea." Now to our text, verse 7. "Woe to the world for its temptations to sin. For it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands or two feet and to be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into the hell of fire." Verse 10. "See that you do not despise one of these little ones, For I tell you that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly, I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. As with all things regarding the word, kind of a general Bible study tool that was told to me years ago that I think is helpful is, what is this saying, and then what is it saying about what it's saying? Which is why I think it's important to read Matthew 18, the first few verses of it, because the context is important. This is where, in the first few verses, that's where it establishes when the rest of this text talks about the little children, he's talking about the people who are humbly following him. Also, it's important to remember that he's talking to the disciples themselves. I think sometimes, and I fall into this trap, it's like, wait, who is Jesus talking to? Because I want to default to whenever he's teaching or whenever he says, whoa, right? He must be talking to the big bad guys, the Pharisees, right? But no, he's talking to the disciples here. And second, like what else is happening? We have to remember that the disciples came to Jesus and said, how can we be the greatest in heaven? And like that's a really interesting thing, because we see in other passages of the Gospels, we see even disciples coming to Jesus and saying, oh, which of us can sit on your right hand and your left hand? We want to be the really powerful ones. And I think it's important because this is when Jesus goes and says, as a response to this, he gives this discourse that includes, shall we say, these woes and a parable. So, focusing on verses 7 through 9, I'll read it again. He says, woe to the world for temptations to sin, for it is necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. And if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than with two hands or two feet to be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into hell of fire. First point, and I cannot emphasize this more, God is serious about sin. I was reading an article, and I was actually talking to people about this earlier, but some people want to talk about like Jesus is like really, like they present him fairly soft, right? He's just loving all the time, and he's just, yes. But he also gets like serious and graphic, right? Like, this is how serious it is to hate sin. This is a big deal. Now, it's obviously strong metaphoric language. Like, if like all of our hands have caused us to sin at one point, and we all aren't missing our hands, right? Like, he's not like telling the disciples like, hey, cut off your hands literally, but he's saying it is this serious. Why is he serious about this sin? To enter life. If you look at the text twice, he says, it is better to cut off your hands or your feet and to be lame to enter life than to be thrown into eternal fire. And then he repeats it again with your eyes. It's better for you to pluck out your eye or tear out your eye and throw it away, be gone with it, than it is better for you to enter life that way than have two eyes and be thrown into fire. We see an important characteristic about God here. he's serious about sin, and they, him and sin, life and death, one is categorized by God and one is categorized by sin. This is, they do not mix. They don't co-mingle, right? It's not even like oil and water, like they're in the same cup, right? No, they are completely separate. And as we're going through this, that's our first point. And there's two points regarding, at least that I see here and feel called to teach on today in these three verses. But they are mingled together. So the second point, which is married to the first, is as the church, we must be radically and selflessly concerned with holiness. Now, this is maybe one of those no-duhs. Maybe you were more enlightened than I was. But coming into this, it was one of these things where it's like, this is so obvious here. And I think sometimes, again, as I've read this and I've talked to others about this passage, and it's like, holy smokes, like God is so serious about this. And he's talking to his people about this. And this is his response to their semi-competitive, how do we be great in the kingdom? And the context is him saying, no, you got to be humble like these little ones. And what's going on here is we see that as he warns his disciples, about sin and temptations to sin. He's warning them both on an individual and a collective level. So collectively, he says, he's warning those, and he says in verse 7, he says, woe to the world and the temptations to sin. And I think we get that. I think we get that, yes, there are people who are not walking with God, and there's temptations over there. But then if you notice the next line, he says, it's necessary for temptations to come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. And I think that this is one of those maybe sneaky ones that can get us. He's teaching the disciples, and they had asked maybe a seemingly innocent question, how can we be great in your kingdom, right? And he responds with, you got to be humble. Now, I don't know if you're at all like me. When I see competitiveness, I want to beat the person who's being competitive by any means necessary. If someone's being competitive, like, let's go. Let's do it. I get excited for those types of things. This flips my kingdom upside down. Because if I'm being honest, the line between healthy competition and causing your brother to be tempted to sin is a fine line, a very fine line. I mean, I don't have a lot of time to tell stories, but I'll tell one. My dad, when I was young, he used to take us to go like play basketball and play football, and we play ultimate frisbee like out in the street, and like, you know, like all these different things. And like every time, man, I'd fight with someone. Like I just like verbally like argue a call or like argue against something. And even today I have to restrain that. What was it doing? It was firing up other people, and we get into fights, and we get into arguments. And you know what would have resolved all of this? Be humble like a little kid. I'm just happy to shoot a ball, guys. Let's go. And I think that, and I want to tell that because it illustrates the greater point, which is like we can cause people to sin when we're just doing our thing if we're not careful. And he's warning against that right here. And he's saying, whoa, look out that you aren't tempting people around you to sin. And I think that that's an important thing, right? We can tend to, even in community, amongst people that we love, why are they bent out of shape? Oh, well, you know, that's just them. They're just doing their thing. Well, maybe we are, we've instigated that, and, you know, there's cause for the sin to creep in. Jesus is warning against that. So, if you remember how much Jesus hates sin, he talks about it before. If you cause any of these little ones, these humble servants of God, to sin, it's better to throw a giant heavy weight around your neck and drown. This is a continuation of that thought. So we need to be radically committed to each other's holiness. How? By being radically committed to our holiness. Look at this. He doesn't say, and if their hand causes them to sin, cut it off. Right? Like, yikes. But no, it says in verse 8, and if your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. We have to take action towards holiness on an individual basis as well. This is similar, and it reminds me of Matthew 7. Remember, judge not lest you be judged. Love that verse. Just, sorry, that was like tongue-in-cheek, and I don't have time to go into the tongue-in-cheek. So afterwards, it talks about planks and specks. And there's a part later on in there where it says, no, do help remove the speck out of their eye. How do you do that? Well, you have to be refining of each other. But what does it say first? Is it says to remove the plank out of your own eye. So this here, do some plank maintenance. Look, if your limbs are causing you to sin, cut it out. Take radical steps against the temptation to sin. Do you know what some of those radical steps are for me? I try not to play a lot of sports with the youth. It just kind of is how it is. Or like, if I am, I'm 100% not taking it seriously. Like, there's no need for me to like crush both figuratively, literally, spiritually, emotionally, like all these ways that I want to beat the competition to a 16-year-old, right? Like, it doesn't help anyone. If anything, it's probably causing him to sin because there's going to be resentment against me later on, right? That's why I haven't told the youth, and I mean, I'll tell you guys this and the youth that are here, like, I scored 6 goals and had 3 assists on Friday night at Broomball. I didn't tell them that afterwards. I didn't want to instigate and rub in. But similarly, notice what it's doing in our own hearts. Notice what the temptation to sin does, and are you radically removing yourself from it? I know people who are so dramatic in this. They're addicted to their smartphones, and I'm kind of feeling it a little bit. This is my old phone. It's got a derpy picture of Lincoln on the background, which I love. I haven't had it in like a year. But like, I can't call or do text or anything right now, and I didn't have this phone until last night. And yesterday I realized, like, holy smokes, those people who take radical steps to recognize that they're addicted to their phones and they go and get a flip phone, there's something to that. If it's causing you to sin, are you going to take the radical step to get rid of it? How can we expect to live as, we'll see later, sheep in a fold if we aren't committed to holiness and what the shepherd is all about? We must be radically committed to both our personal pursuit of holiness and our collective pursuit of holiness. But it's different, and I want to point this last one out. How do we collectively pursue holiness? Not by walking around and being like, hey, John, you've sinned, and you should cut this out. Monique, you've sinned, you should cut this out. And Keenan, you know, like, no. I need to cause you not to sin. And I need to trust that John individually is pursuing holiness by himself, and I'm going to try to do nothing to stop that and walk alongside him in pursuing that. It's upside down, right? It's not, we see in the word that this concept of keeping no record of wrongs, right? Like, when we go around and we say, hey, you need to do this, you need to do that, and you're like, yeah. We make it about us, right? We make it about, like, this is your problem, and I'll deal with me. But what this is encouraging towards is how, this whole text, how to live in community together, and how do we do that? By radically pursuing holiness individually and collectively. And the way we do it collectively is by not causing your brother to sin, not even giving them the temptation to it. I'm done for the day. So no, I'm just kidding. Like, that's a huge point. And like, this is the point that I really, really want to drive home, because it like, we're going to kind of cruise through this next parable. And the reason why is because if we understand this, then the parable is simple. I do have a quote, because I like quotes. If you guys have read The Pursuit of Holiness by Jerry Bridges, it's pretty good. So here's a quote from it. In the deceitfulness of our hearts, we sometimes play with temptation. Mind you, this is talking about the temptations to sin, not just sin itself. Jerry Bridges says, in the deceitfulness of our hearts, we sometimes play with temptation by entertaining the thought that we can always confess and later ask forgiveness. Such thinking is exceedingly dangerous. God's judgment is without partiality. He never overlooks our sin. He never decides not to bother, since the sin is only a small one. No, God hates sin intensely, whenever and wherever he finds it. So if you want a question, and if you spent time with me, I usually, if I'm driving home a good point, a point that I think is strong, I usually ask it as a rhetorical question, because I want it to stick a little bit. But here's the question to us is, do I hate sin as much as God hates sin? That's how we turn to holiness. So moving forward, as we understand this, the parable of the lost sheep makes a lot of sense. I don't think it's fairly complex. We'll dive into it a little bit, but I think sometimes we can want to take the story of the lost sheep and just really hone in on the parables, right? And potential metaphors and relationships between us and the parable, right? But we have to remember, this is to the disciples who are being competitive and trying to get on the leaderboard, right, so to speak. Jesus is warning them that that's a bad thing. And then he follows up with this parable. There's a teaching moment here, and he does it with a story that will stick. Let's read. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I tell you that in heaven their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Now, again, when we approach a text, what is it saying? Then what is it saying about what it's saying? And then what's our application? So first, we have to remember who the little ones are. Some have taken this and isolated, little ones must mean child, and therefore, like whoever leads a child astray is in a great sin. And, you know, like yes, that there is truth to that, but I don't think that's what this is teaching here. Remember, it's saying that the little ones, in the context of the chapter, in the context of what Jesus is, I hesitate to say chapter, right? In the context of this discourse with the disciples, the little ones are those that are humbly following him. The ones who have said, yeah, Jesus, and yes, I am committed to not causing my brother to temptation to sin. I'm committed to personal holiness. I'm committed to following you. I'm committed to being part of that group of people. So then Jesus comes in with a teaching. And he comes in and he says, hey, here's a group that you all know, agricultural people. Sheep. And you've probably heard it before, like, and if you haven't, I'm not a farmer. I don't keep sheep. I'm not a shepherd. But from what I've heard, sheep aren't the brightest animals that exist, and that they kind of need to stay in a group, and they need a shepherd. And they're wholly dependent on the shepherd. So as soon as he starts talking about sheep, the disciples go, yeah, those dumb things. Oh, wait, I'm supposed to be humble, right? Jesus is making it really clear. I'm the shepherd and you're the sheep. Remember how you're not supposed to tempt them to sin? Well, good, non-sin is with me in the flock. One's gone astray and it's coming back. I'm going to go find it. Now, there's an interesting little verse here it's a sentence of a verse. It says, for I tell you, in verse 10, that in heaven, their angels always see the face of my Father who is in heaven. And it's one of these interesting little lines that even I was like, should I teach on it? And then as I studied it more, I was like, this is really important. Is that in his all-powerful, all-knowingness, God has commissioned a group of his messengers to help look out and help the sheep and look after them. As he goes, and in this parable, which isn't even a perfect description, it's an illustration to them so they can better understand how they are supposed to be, that when one is separated, he's going to correct them back to holiness and to this group of people, this collection. He's got angels who are looking out after these people as well. You can think of very tangible examples of this, right? Daniel in the lion's den and the lion's mouths being closed. You can think of how various other angels have interacted with people throughout the Bible. But also, I was reading something, and you know, some people have interpreted this in many ways, but there's a certain level of protection that comes with being part of the community as well, right? A wolf is looking for the isolated one on its own, and Jesus protects that isolated one and brings him back to the fold. One wolf does not go attack 99 sheep. Similarly, 99 sheep don't need 99 angels or 99 shepherds. There's one shepherd. All together for his purpose. Now, what does this teach us? How do we work with this? One thing that is radical, and again, there's the joke, right? If you start preaching exegetically and you start getting really deep into it, that you will just spend the rest of your life in like one book of the Bible, right? And you're like, and we don't want to do this. So I did more, but I want to maybe discuss amongst yourselves later this concept that the God of the universe goes after people, humans, because we have nothing we can provide to the Father. And yet the God of the universe comes after us. You could spend the rest of your life trying to comprehend this, and you won't fully comprehend this. But today, you can comprehend it enough that it brings you to a place of humble sheephood before God. God, I need you. I need what you provided for me. I need the flock that you brought around us. I didn't choose the sheep that's next to me, but you did, and that's good enough. I'm going to not let them sin. I'm going to do my best not to tempt them to sin. I'm going to humbly be part of that flock. Is there no more profound thing? The all-knowing God of the universe gathers people together, humble people together to serve a purpose. And then another one, another lesson from this parable. And I think the English kind of maybe loses a little bit of, or the potency of what it's saying. But if we see in verse 13, when he finds the one that was lost, truly, he says to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. Now, again, confessions with Mike. When I was young, I was like, and maybe you're part of this, right? So I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand because it's not Tuesday night, but maybe I will. When I was young, I was like, man, my testimony is not good enough. I didn't stray far enough from the flock. You guys know what I'm talking about? And as I've grown older and gotten to meet people and that type of stuff, I've strayed too far from the flock, right? But, and when I read this when I was young, it was, I need to stray farther from the flock so God can rejoice more. But I think what the meaning is that is lost, and this is kind of the second part of this, is God rejoices because that lost one that was part of the whole from before, God rejoices because the flock is complete again. God rejoices because there isn't one missing anymore, but because everyone's together again, pursuing holiness. This isn't a, like, oh, Jesus knows of a lost sheep randomly on another hill, and he's going to go try to find it. No, this is one from the flock went astray. And when it comes back together, when it comes back to its rightful place, he rejoices because all his sheep are together again. Why? Because humbly following the shepherd is the best thing for us. It's the best thing for his sheep. Not, now imagine you're a shepherd, and I think maybe we can relate to this, especially if you have a kid, and I only have one. But like, imagine all the sheep said, hey, on the count of three, we're going to try to get to the tallest hill on our own. those dumb sheep are going to hurt themselves. The best thing for the sheep is to be surrounded by a shepherd. Hey, here's some grass for you to eat. I'm going to take you to the next good grass for you to eat. And you know what? We'll shear your wool. You won't even know it's missing, and you'll help, right? And you go and do this, and you go and do that, and you get moved from place to place. Not competitively trying to find the tallest hill. And I know that kind of breaks down a little bit, right? If you go farther with the metaphor, right? But remember the context. If we are living by leaderboard faith, right? There's only one person that can hold each spot. But Jesus says, hey, everyone get low, get humble, and you'll be part of a whole. The leaderboard won't even matter. Why? We see it here at the end of 14. The Father doesn't want anyone following him to perish. It's that simple. The best thing for the sheep to protect them from perishing is to be with the flock. And I think the tie is decently strong. A common way for sheep to leave the flock is when we start having competitive leaderboard faith. When we start saying, how can we be the greatest? Instead of saying, hey, just use me. So the lessons, just to kind of wrap it up a little bit, because I know Matt did 3 songs at the beginning, and that theoretically would give me more time, but John did a prayer time, so he took away my time. I'm just kidding. But the application, let's drive this home. It's not a competition for time. And if you know me, I strive to say things in the positive. But for this application point, I'm going to say it both in the positive and the negative. Love holiness and hate sin like God does. In our individual lives and in us towards others in community. My man Jerry Bridges faith. A humble person doesn't compare testimonies. A humble person doesn't keep a tab of how many dollars he's donated to the homeless guy, you know, on the corner. A humble person doesn't count the hours or minutes that they stay after church to engage with the flock. A humble person doesn't say, it's a lie, but it's a white lie, right? A humble person doesn't say, you know, lying, cheating, stealing is bad, except when I'm playing the game when it's good, right? Like, Cheater's Monopoly, like, I don't get it, right? Like, I saw it on Christmas. Anyway, a humble person says, these are the things of God and I strive for them in every single aspect, period. A humble person says, I don't know it all. God revealed to me more ways to be humble. Because if I'm the one who's defining it, then we've already lost humbleness before God. I've already gone astray. So, let us commit to loving holiness, loving holiness in the flock around us, and being humble before God. Let's pray.